The Open Door of Emptiness, a collection of public talks and teachings by James Lowe. Preface. Although the word emptiness can seem a bit intimidating, in the Buddhist traditions, it is the key to freedom. Our mind is intrinsically empty of self and any fixed or defining content. We are not defined by anything which has occurred, that is occurring now, or will ever occur in the future. Being empty of fixed content allows us to open to all that occurs without being trapped in reactivity. By resting in the intrinsic openness of our mind, it becomes clear that we are not a thing amongst things. The sky-like openness of our mind as it is neither grasps at arisings nor effortfully discards them. No occurrence can touch or affect the mind as it is. Occurrences do contact and impinge on patterns of interpretation and identification that we, as ego selves, have come to rely on. By opening to our own unborn openness, we are freed from the delusion that our transient patterning points to the truth of who we are. The chapters in this book offer fresh ways of viewing our situation so that we can awaken to our true essence and to freedom. Chapter 1. Getting to know how we are. Part 1, including the two truths and Tantra as a method to purify impure relative truth. Let's start by thinking about our ordinary everyday life. All the things that we rely on and take refuge in. The places where we stay, the warm bed where we sleep, our clothes, our cooking materials, our books, everything that we rely on to create our sense of who we are and our safe, familiar world. One view within Buddhism is that these things on which we rely in our ordinary life are somehow dangerous for us because they pull us into attachment. If we follow this view, we try to lessen and renounce our attachment to these things by explicitly taking refuge instead in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. We use our reliance on a Buddhist refuge to protect us from our tendency to get caught up in the things of this world, and our attachment thereby increasing. Another view in Buddhism, the Mahayana view, is that the idea and fact of emptiness helps us to understand that all the things that we are attached to, all the things we take refuge in as a support for our ordinary life, are devoid of inherent self-nature. We then want to take refuge in the Buddha, not as someone apart from the world, but Buddha as the spirit of awareness, the attitude of awareness which recognizes the essential emptiness of all things. This view does not restrict our freedom to be in the world. It is not a path of renunciation. We continue to make use of all the things that we ordinarily make use of, but without being tied up in them. In fact, the view of emptiness encourages using all these ordinary objects of attachment as a means of opening ourselves to deeper and deeper understanding of the Dharma. Using our attachment onto everyday objects as the path leads to understanding that our grasping is what is creating the duality of subject and object. One of the particular qualities of Mahayana Buddhism and of Tantra and Dzogchen is the tension between a confident certainty that a direct realization of the integration of samsara and nirvana is possible, alongside the humility of recognizing that this is very difficult to achieve. Tantra requires of us a paradoxical or double movement. Through the experience of the meditation, we develop a full faith in the realization of the world as a Buddha field of perfect enlightenment, whilst at the same time deconstructing our tendency to solidify that view. We want to develop faith, respect, and devotion to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, whilst at the same time using the vision of full enlightenment to deconstruct the attitude of faith that might be solidified into a kind of endless, helpless humility. We seek not to establish hope and humility as two polarities in dualistic opposition, but rather to see them as two points in a dance, whereby they deconstruct and open each other as they play and unfold. The kindness, which is the hope that all beings will awaken, is inseparable from the clarity that all beings are inseparable from emptiness. We develop kindness towards illusory beings. This is the warmth of the two truths, the relative truth of diverse appearances, and the absolute truth that emptiness is the nature of all phenomena. The text by Cheksampa in Simply Being says that you must believe whatever the guru does is good. It is good because it is empty of inherent existence. This is the absolute nature, which offers no actual basis for judgment. If you don't understand that it is empty, then whatever he does will just strengthen your judgment. This is good. This is bad. The practice of emptiness is for grown-ups. It's not for children. Insight into emptiness creates a subjective experience which will free us by shifting our experience from a dualistic paradigm to a non-dualistic paradigm. We use devotion to the guru or the deity in order to experience our helplessness, our vulnerability, and our neediness. We hollow out our ego self so that we can merge with the deity. The more empty of self we are, the more we're able to become the deity and thereby access the qualities required for liberating all sentient beings. True kindness arises from emptiness and does not stray from it. In the Mahayana Tibetan tradition, we believe that if we pray to Padmasambhava, he will come and save us by letting us experience our true nature. This is a method for understanding the nature of our mind by using the dualistic power of devotion to open the door to non-duality. This method is even more helpful if we can see Padmasambhava in the form of our own teacher. This is because our habit of seeing somebody as their flesh and blood body is dissolved by directly encountering their light body. It is our own attachment to the idea of materiality that obscures the actual nature of phenomena. Tantric visualization allows us to see that materiality is simply a dull and thick way of experiencing light. Let's say you want to emigrate to America. You need to go through the American embassy. Imagine you're living in a very poor country. Perhaps you're an Indian farmer in Bihar, and you decide you want to go to America. You would take the long, local, cheap passenger train all the way to Delhi, sitting on a hard wooden seat. Then you would walk through the streets of Delhi. It's very hot. It's very tiring. Out to Chanyakapuri. And you would go to the American embassy. You'd go through the front door, if they let you in, and enter an air-conditioned room. There's a very comfortable seat. You think, ah, I'm in America. I want to stay here forever. Just then, the doorman says, we're closing for lunch. You have to go out now. However, you remember that when you went to school in the village, they told you that America was a wonderful democratic country, where they announced that they would welcome people from all over the world, the sick, the poor, the downtrodden. And so you reply, I am exactly that. I am a poor, downtrodden peasant from Bihar. I want to stay here, in America. But then the doorman comes and puts you outside the door. So the business of actually getting to America itself is very hard. You need, if possible, to have some friends who are already in America who will help you. Auntie Tara, Uncle Amitabha, Grandpa Chenrezig, please send me a letter of invitation so I can come too. Then, if you have good karma, you get a green card and you can go and settle there. If you have less good karma, you can go on a tourist visit. Whether or not you have good relatives over there who will help you, you still have to go through the embassy. And the embassy is both friendly and unfriendly. Often, it operates according to rules you don't really understand. You imagine that something is clear. You hand over your passport. You expect to get a visa. But they come back and say, sorry, some mistake. You have to go back to your village and get the head man to stamp it. So the guru is very much like the American embassy. Sometimes looks very nice. Sometimes looks very not nice. Sometimes helpful. Sometimes not so helpful. The guru is not a place to go and live. The guru is not a place to live. It is just an embassy. The ambassador lives in the embassy, but for other people who are travelling, it is just a place of transit. You go to the embassy for a purpose. You go to the guru for a purpose. If the peasant from Bihar falls asleep while waiting in this beautiful air-conditioned embassy, he may dream that he is already in America and that everything is safe, but at a certain point, he'll have to wake up from the dream. You hear people saying such things as, when I met this Lama, I felt so good. I spent some months with him in India, and it was really wonderful. But then, I had to come back to the West, and it is so difficult for me now. I just want to earn enough money to go back to India and hang out with this guru. Then I'll feel very good. The danger in this is that you turn the guru into a kind of embassy hotel in which you have the false illusion that just by hanging out there, you are in the place to be. When you go to Dharma centers, or you go to see lamas, or you go on pilgrimage, or to India, or somewhere like that, it's very easy to mistake the embassy, the transition point for the final destination. You have lost your purpose or intention. Dharma centers or Dharma places, as they exist in the world, always need work to sustain them. If you become part of a Dharma center, it is very important that you participate in the work and help it to thrive. Yet helping Dharma centers to grow, or building monasteries, or printing books, can easily eat up all your time and become a way of avoiding looking at your mind. Dharma texts use many terms like path, way, vehicle, all of them referring to journeying and travelling. A path leads somewhere. In dualistic terms, there is better than here. Nirvana is better than samsara. And so I have to keep my eye on my goal. There are many pit stops along the path of duality, but none of them is deeply reliable because we are looking to the other for help. People and places can give us the energy, enthusiasm, and commitment to continue our journey. The guru becomes the point of entry or transition into a deeper understanding of our journey. If our peasant from Bihar, who had saved up a lot of money for his ticket to America, got his visa and then was so grateful to this wonderful embassy that had given him a visa, that he went to the market and used all his plane ticket money to buy lots of butter lamps and put them all around the embassy. If he did all that with a great puja to worship the glorious embassy of the United States of America, if he did all that, he wouldn't be able to get on the aeroplane. People can become so intoxicated with the presence of a teacher that, in worshipping this person, they forget that they actually need to make use of this person to get somewhere. Teachers are methods. We need to learn how to make use of this method. If the guru is used well, the journey becomes very short. The two truths. The two truths are usually referred to as relative truth and absolute truth. Essentially, relative truth means whatever is constructed using the organizational frame of a perceiving subject and an object that is perceived. Relative truth is subdivided into pure relative truth and impure relative truth. Impure relative truth is the relative truth in which you perceive objects as real and you have attachment to them. Pure relative truth is when you perceive objects as real, but you have no attachment to them. Absolute truth is when you neither perceive objects nor have any attachment to them. To perceive an object means to perceive something which appears to exist in truth, in and of itself. Here I have a watch, one which I am very attached to. We can see it, and we perceive it as something existing in truth. We know what to do with it. We can read the dial and it makes sense. We have a lot of mental constructs which can be located around this object. I have a particular attachment to this watch because it is my watch. But even if this isn't your watch, you will have an attachment to it as something which supports whatever attitudes you have that let you know that it is a watch. So we have an attachment to the concept of watch, and we strengthen that every time we look at the watch and think we know what a watch is. We are attached both to our concepts which allow us to identify this as an object, an entity, a thing in itself, and to our skills of identification and signification, by which we focus on the specific characteristics of this particular watch. We might be able to free ourselves from attachment to concrete entities like watches. We might decide that we will go and live in a cave, living very simply and renouncing the world. However, the method of conceptualization that we employ for making sense of the world is one which has attachment embedded in it. Not only that, but we are attached to the meaning-making patterns of signification that exist in language. It's through our attachment to language as a meaning-making device that we create the identity that we have as a separate phenomenon taking up a place amongst other phenomena. This level of attachment is very difficult to recognize because it's so normal for us. In using language, we are dealing with an intangible, metaphorical constructive system which creates the illusion of real things existing in truth. Language, as a system of signification, creates a particular world of meaning which we imagine to have a precise correlation with objects that exist in the world. A watch appears to be what is here, but we have to remember that the watch we see is inseparable from the concepts we employ to see it. The watch doesn't exist in itself. It is a site of interpretation and cannot be contained within any specific definition. Our education leads us to believe that language has a direct relationship to what is out there. Indeed, that language is derived from objects that exist in reality in the world. What we encounter in the world, what appears to be a series of discrete, separate objects having their own qualities, is actually an interplay of language and conceptualization, which is moving and shifting and creating the boundaries between one identification and another. So in saying, "This is my watch," I am both making a statement referring back to me in terms of my possession of this object, and I'm also talking about the object as something that exists in truth, that can be recognized as a real object, recognized by everyone here. Thus, my belief that this is my watch is a statement from within impure relative truth. There is my sense of the watch itself taken to be an independent entity. This is an aspect of mental dullness and lack of insight. And there is my sense of ownership of it, which generates desire for it and aversion towards anyone who might take it or damage it. Sometimes, when we come out of our meditation, we look, and it is as if something is there. But what it is, we don't quite know until we start the business of attaching thoughts and language again to experience. When we come out of meditation, we may sometimes have had the experience of a kind of a gap that we just kind of open, and then the world becomes a bit more concrete. Similarly, if we run very fast until we get out of breath and then stop, there is a kind of an openness. Or maybe in sex, you could have that kind of experience of being just a little bit knocked open. It's that kind of moment. There's a gap, and then language conceptualization comes in to fill the gap. In Buddhism, as in most religions, there are spiritual practices designed to encourage this disruption. For example, the practice of silence in Zen monasteries. When you practice silence, something arises and you may want to tell it to someone to confirm the nature of your experience as a kind of feedback loop that strengthens the reality of things. But if you are unable to speak because you have taken a vow of silence, for example, something arises, yet you can't turn it into something, you can't solidify it. So it tends to remain rather thin. Tantra as a method to purify impure relative truth. The tantric tradition makes use of mantras. Although the syllables of the mantra can be ascribed meaning, the meaning of the mantra, syllable by syllable, is not the main thing. The main thing is that on one level, they are meaningless sound. That is to say, the meaning of these sounds does not belong inside the matrix of meaning which we ordinarily use in the world. The word mantra means mind protector because it stops the mind from getting woven into the web of dualistic meaning which is embedded in language. On the level of ordinary meaning, when you recite a mantra, you are saying something that has no meaning. If you have done mantra practice for any length of time, you may have experienced feeling a bit spaced out. Saying mantra and using a mala does have signification on a cultural and sociological level, such as being a Tibetan Buddhist or whatever. That is an ordinary level. However, in doing the practice, there is a disorientation because thoughts rest on words and mantra is using sound to disrupt the ordinary use of language, which is to appropriate and colonize the world into samsaric dualistic meaning. This desire to own the world by making sense of it is very profound. This arises as the process of the unfolding of the four-stage development of ignorance. The first stage is the forgetfulness of the openness of our presence. Thus, being here, fresh and open, is lost to us as direct experience, since we cleave to the more dense sense that I am here. This leads to the second stage, where I have a sense of being other than you while still being connected with you. Self and other are born together, two seeming entities whose actual absence of autonomy binds them together. From this arises the third stage. The third stage describes how, once openness is lost and the mind starts to look for something, the vast array of entities is organized by the use of signs, generating a competence in identifying specific entities by employing their name or designation. This is the seductive intelligence which can name all things, yet not penetrate to the true nature of how they are. We are absolutely convinced that this is reality, because we've been brought up to believe that each phenomenon is just itself, due to this specificity being the expression of its unique essence. Moreover, this sense of the knowability of everything is the ground or basis of karma. Being unaware of how karma operates is the fourth stage of ignorance. Karma is generated through the alignment of the following four factors, being sure that both I and you are real. An intention, good or bad, towards you arises in me. I can then act this out and then review what I have done. If these four factors are all aligned, The full karmic force of this action will manifest at a later date, and I, in whatever form I am then, will experience the force of that karmic formation. When this process is not understood, it is called ignorance, or unawareness of being dull regarding the operation of karma. As meditators, our aim is to reduce the intensity of the five afflictive emotions: mental dullness, desire, aversion, pride, and jealousy. With this, we can start to see appearances without being carried away by strong reactions. Then, we can begin to focus on the empty nature of phenomena, the startling fact that there are actually no self-existing objects, although we talk as if there were. The more we see the actual impermanence of phenomena, the more the delusional nature of the beliefs we have been operating under becomes apparent. We have been grasping at clouds, falling in love with echoes, feeling aversion towards mirages. This reframing or re-identification of the nature of phenomena as they arise moment by moment gradually loosens our tendency to solidify and reify. Subject and object are experienced as playing together. The world arises again as revelation, revelation in emptiness, as emptiness, of emptiness. Through that, one enters into the experience of absolute truth, in which, although we say that nothing is occurring, clearly everything is occurring, but everything is occurring as nothing. It is the revelation within mirror-like awareness. This is the real focus of Dzogchen meditation: to experience the world as the continuing, spontaneous revelation which never becomes born as this or that with subject-object separation. From the book The Open Door of Emptiness by James Lowe. Read by Wendy, October 2024.